Welcome, everyone. I'm really thrilled you're joining us for another deep dive today.
Absolutely, we've got a great one.
We really do. We are taking on a mission today that frankly aims right at the heart of, well, the single most important question you can ask as an investor.
Yeah, the big one.
Right. If you spend any time at all looking at the market or, checking your retirement accounts or just watching financial news, you hear the exact same question repeated on a loop every single day. What should I buy?
Everyone wants the ticker symbol.
Exactly. They want the hot tip. They want that three-letter acronym that's going to double by next Tuesday. But today, we are flipping that completely on its head. Instead of asking what to buy, we are asking a fundamentally more powerful question: why does it compound?
It really is the ultimate question.
Yeah.
And, it's the difference between memorizing a list of answers for a test and actually understanding the underlying subject.
Right, getting to the root of it.
Yeah, because when you just ask what to buy, you end up with this portfolio of isolated, disconnected ideas. You buy a tech stock because your brother-in-law mentioned it at a barbecue.
You've all been there.
You buy a commodity ETF because you read an article about inflation, and you buy a retailer because you like their stores.
Right.
But when you ask why does it compound, you start to build a structural understanding of wealth creation. You start looking for the engine under the hood. And that deep structural understanding is really the only thing that will keep you anchored when the market inevitably gets chaotic.
And to help us build that exact understanding, we are diving deep into a remarkable piece of writing today. We are looking at a post titled The Physics of Compounding.
It's a brilliant piece.
It is, and it's a core part of a much larger, truly fascinating series and book project called Averaging Up: The Infinite Investor by Jocelyn Dubey. Now, before we get into the physics and all the formulas, we need to set the stage regarding who Jocelyn Dubey actually is, because the perspective here is incredibly unique.
The first thing you need to know about Jocelyn Dubey is that he operates entirely outside the standard Wall Street machinery.
Which is refreshing.
Very. He's an independent thinker. He's not a fund manager trying to subtly sell you on his mutual fund's latest strategy.
Right, there's no hidden agenda.
Exactly. He's not a financial advisor trying to gather your assets. And he is certainly not a traditional academic writing esoteric theoretical papers for a university journal that no one actually reads.
Thank goodness for that.
Yeah. Dubey builds his frameworks entirely from first principles.
Hmm.
He is looking at long-term investing through the lenses of hard sciences. We're talking physics, chemistry, thermodynamics, and mathematics.
It sounds intense.
It is,
Yeah.
but he's stripping away all the usual financial jargon, the EBITDA multiples, the moving averages, the Fed funds rate
What
speculations.
about the noise?
Exactly the noise. And he's asking a much harder question. What are the actual fundamental physical laws governing how capital multiplies over time?
I have to admit, when I first read the premise, I was a little skeptical.
Sure, it sounds a bit out there.
Yeah, like applying literal physics to the stock market sounds like it could just be a clever marketing gimmick. But as you dig into Dubey's framework, you realize he isn't speaking in metaphors.
Not at all.
Okay, let's unpack this. He argues that true unstoppable compounding isn't about finding a business with a brilliant CEO who makes genius decisions every quarter.
Right.
It is not about a clever marketing strategy or a slick ad campaign or some well-timed corporate acquisition. He's basically saying that the best wealth creation doesn't care about human decisions at all. It runs on physical, structural laws.
That is the massive paradigm shift for you, the listener, today. We live in a financial world that is completely overwhelmingly obsessed with human action.
Just turn on CNBC.
Exactly. If you turn on Bloomberg or CNBC, it is wall-to-wall coverage of what people are doing: trading, predicting, forecasting, reacting to an employment report, trying to guess what the chairman of the Federal Reserve might say next week.
It's exhausting just watching it.
It is. The entire industry is built on this premise that activity generates returns. But Dubey argues that the most powerful, durable compounding happens when businesses obey structural, physical laws rather than human decisions.
The structures do the work.
Exactly. The greatest wealth engines don't rely on a manager making a hero-level move every 90 days. They rely on structures that run automatically, like a law of nature.
And to understand how these automated wealth engines actually work in the real world, we first have to learn the vocabulary of the averaging up framework.
Right, the basics.
Yeah. Dubey deconstructs literally any business into a very simple two-part fundamental equation. He breaks it down into A and B.
A and B. Simple enough.
Right. A represents the existing operations of the business. You can think of A as the moat, the recurring cash flow, the toll that the business collects today just by turning the lights on. It is the solid ground the company currently stands on.
The foundation.
Exactly. Then you have B. B represents the growth. It is the secular expansion of the addressable market. B is the wave that is pushing the business forward into the future.
And most investors, frankly, spend all their time arguing over the size of B.
Oh, totally. Total addressable market is everyone's favorite buzzword.
Yeah, they want to find the biggest TAM, the most massive wave. They look for the next trillion-dollar industry. But Dubé argues that what separates a merely okay business from an extraordinary generational wealth-creating machine isn't the size of the growth wave.
Okay.
It is the cost of capturing that growth.
The cost of B. Let's ground this with some of the contrasting examples Dubé provides, because this is where the theory really hits reality.
Did you?
Think about a company like ASML. For anyone unfamiliar, ASML makes the incredibly complex lithography machines that print the world's most advanced microchips.
Basically a monopoly on the high end.
Yeah, they essentially have a monopoly on the most advanced semiconductor manufacturing equipment. They have a massive wave of growth, right? Their B is huge because the world needs an infinite amount of computing power for AI, smartphones, EVs.
The wave is undeniable.
But to capture that growth, to actually ride that wave, ASML has to spend something like $15 billion in research and development for every new generation of their machines. The cost of B is absolutely enormous.
Or look at Amazon's retail business. They are riding a massive secular wave of global e-commerce. But capturing that wave requires tens of billions of dollars in what we call CapEx, capital expenditure.
Building the literal warehouses.
Exactly. This is the hard cash a company has to constantly plow back into the business just to stay relevant. For Amazon, that means building physical warehouses the size of small towns, buying fleets of delivery vans, maintaining massive logistics networks.
It's a heavy lift.
It is. The growth is there. The wave is huge, but it is incredibly expensive to acquire. They have to bleed cash to grow.
Now, contrast those heavy, cash-intensive giants with the archetype that Dubé uses for his framework.
Visa.
Ah, Visa, the classic.
Right. The global volume of electronic payments is a massive secular wave. It grows reliably by roughly 8 to 10% annually as the world slowly but surely moves away from physical cash.
And Visa's revenue grows right alongside that wave at roughly 8 to 10% annually.
But ask yourself, what is the additional capital required for Visa to capture that 8 to 10% growth?
That's the magic question.
The answer is practically nothing. It is the exact same digital network, the same servers, processing more volume, generating more revenue automatically.
I'm going to make sure we are crystal clear on this point for you listening, because it is the unbreakable rule of Dubé's framework. We are talking about situations where the cost of B is zero.
The cost is zero. Not the growth.
Exactly. You must never, ever confuse this with saying B is zero. B, the growth, is very much alive and expanding rapidly. Visa is growing its transaction volumes by billions of dollars. But the cost of facilitating that growth is virtually zero. The marginal cost of processing the billionth and one swipe of a credit card is fractions of a penny, while the revenue scales linearly.
It's mathematically beautiful.
When a business achieves this mathematical perfection, Dubé refers to it as having a free B.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
Visa still has to build data centers, right? I mean, they have to hire software engineers, maintain cybersecurity, run massive marketing campaigns. How can the cost of growth truly be zero?
It's a fair question. And the distinction really lies in the difference between maintenance and expansion. Yes, Visa absolutely has to maintain its network.
Okay.
But if global transaction volumes organically increase by 10% next year because, say, people are buying more coffees and booking more flights,
right.
Visa does not need to build 10% more data centers or hire 10% more engineers to process it. The existing infrastructure absorbs the growth.
Ah, I see.
Unlike Amazon, which literally has to build another physical warehouse to store more physical goods, Visa's digital toll booth simply processes more numbers. The marginal cost of that growth approaches zero.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. The toll booth is already built. The highway just gets busier.
Exactly.
So when you put these pieces together, when a business possesses a free B, meaning its marginal cost to grow is practically zero, and it is actively riding a massive growing wave of secular demand, what do you have?
When you have that specific rare convergence, Dubé classifies that business as a free surfer.
The free surfer.
Yes, the free surfer is the ultimate species in this entire framework. The growth happens automatically, pushed by secular waves, without the need for constant massive capital injections. The business surfs the wave for free.
So now that we have the core vocabulary, we've got A, we've got B, the free B, and the free surfer, now we can really start to apply the science.
This is where it gets fun.
We are moving from the anatomy of the business into the physical laws that govern the market. Let's look at the gradient.
The gradient.
Think of the gradient in physics. Capital seeks the path of least resistance, just like water flowing downhill. Heat naturally flows from a hot area to a cold area. Pressure equalizes from dense areas to sparse areas.
Basic physics.
Right. These aren't choices or decisions being made by the water or the heat. It is a natural law of the universe finding equilibrium.
What's fascinating here is how Dubé applies this to capital. He argues that capital itself has a natural gradient.
A financial gravity.
Exactly. Capital naturally, inevitably migrates from high-cost B businesses to zero-cost B businesses. It flows from heavy physical atoms to weightless digital bits.
It flows downhill.
It flows away from businesses that must bleed cash just to stay in place toward businesses that grow for free. Why? Because the market, over a long enough timeline, is a highly efficient thermodynamic system.
Mm-hmm.
It seeks the highest return on the lowest energy input.
And Dubé doesn't just theorize about this in a vacuum. He provides some brilliant empirical evidence by looking at the actions of master investors.
Truth Hahn is a great example.
Yes, he points to the portfolio of Chris Hahn, the legendary British activist investor who runs TCI. Dubé observed that over three consecutive quarters, Hahn systematically sold off his massive stakes in Canadian Pacific Kansas City.
That is a railroad.
Exactly. You really can't get more heavy, physical, or high capex than a railroad.
No. You are constantly laying steel, repairing engines, dealing with weather. The cost of B is astronomical.
Astronomical. And where did Hahn put all that capital he extracted from the physical railroad? He bought Visa, Moody's, and S&P Global.
Pure information toll booths.
With zero capex requirements. Dubé points out that Hahn wasn't just making a tactical short-term trade based on next quarter's earnings. He was obeying the gradient.
He was moving capital from a high-energy state to a low-energy state.
You see the exact same physical law operating over a much longer timeline with Warren Buffett.
Oh, Buffett's career is the perfect map for this.
It really is. Look at the 60-year arc of his career at Berkshire Hathaway. It's a perfect map of the gradient. Berkshire Hathaway literally started as a textile mill in the 1960s.
Heavy machinery. Physical atoms. Intense labor.
And a very high cost B. Buffett realized very quickly that every time the mill made a profit, he had to spend that profit on upgraded looms just to stay competitive with overseas manufacturers. It was a terrible business.
So he followed the gradient. He migrated his capital into insurance, specifically GEICO and National Indemnity.
Which is a completely different physical structure.
Entirely.
Uh-huh.
Insurance generates float, which is basically other people's money that you get to hold and invest before you have to pay out claims. It is a financial instrument, much lighter than a textile mill, with a much lower cost to be.
It's moving from atoms to paper.
Right. Then, decades later, as the world digitized, he moved massively into Apple. Apple makes physical devices, yes, but it functions as a global technology platform and software ecosystem, which is lighter still.
And if you look at Berkshire's portfolio today, you see massive long-held stakes in companies like Visa and Moody's.
The trajectory of the greatest investor in history isn't just a series of clever stock picks. It is a 60-year illustration of capital migrating toward the zero-cost B.
It's a stark contrast when you put Buffett's early textile days side by side with his modern stakes in digital poll booths. But, and this is important, this brings up a really important question about the nature of these waves.
What's that?
If the capital is flowing this way because of these massive secular trends, like the shift to digital payments or the rise of information services, why doesn't the wave ever just reverse?
Wow.
I mean, water flows downhill, but eventually it pools. Fashions change. Technologies get disrupted. Why does Dubé believe these specific waves are so durable?
To answer that, Dubé brings us to the second law of thermodynamics.
Entropy.
Yes, entropy. The core idea of entropy is that in a closed system, disorder always increases. Time flows in one direction. As Dubé puts it, a broken egg does not spontaneously reassemble itself into a perfect shell.
I love that visual.
It works, right. A sugar cube that dissolves into a cup of hot coffee does not suddenly reconstitute back into a perfect dry cube.
No, it doesn't.
The system has moved to a state that is thermodynamically irreversible. The energy has dispersed.
I understand the egg, but how does a broken egg relate to a credit card transaction?
Dubé analyzes the specific secular wave carrying Visa, which is the digitalization of global payments.
Yep.
Right now, a massive percentage of global transactions, especially in emerging markets, are still done in physical cash.
Sure.
But every year, a fraction of that migrates to digital. Dubé points out that this migration isn't just a consumer fad, like a new social media app. It is driven by four very distinct, independent actors who all benefit from the system moving to a lower energy state.
Let's break down those four actors because this is where the irreversibility really clicks.
Let's do it.
First, you have governments. Governments love digital payments.
They really do.
Why? Because they provide total traceability and enforce tax compliance. It is incredibly hard to hide digital money from the IRS or the European tax authorities compared to hiding a suitcase full of physical cash. Digital money brings the gray economy into the light.
That's actor one.
Right. Second, you have the banks. Banks absolutely love digital payments because they get to collect a tiny fraction of a percent, a transaction fee, on every single swipe, tap, or click. They obviously don't get a cut when you hand someone a $20 bill at a garage sale.
Exactly. Then you have the third actor, the merchants.
The stores, the restaurants, the online retailers.
Right. Merchants want speed, security, and higher average ticket sizes at the point of sale. Tapping a card is vastly faster than a cashier counting out change.
Much faster.
It drastically reduces the risk of employee theft or getting robbed because there are no large amounts of cash on the premises. Plus, psychological studies show consumers spend more when using plastic or phones than when handing over physical bills.
It doesn't feel like real money when you tap your phone.
It really doesn't. And finally, you have the fourth actor. The consumers themselves. Consumers ultimately want frictionless convenience. Tapping a smartphone or a smartwatch to pay for a coffee is structurally more convenient than finding an ATM, paying a withdrawal fee, and carrying around paper and coins.
So you have these four massive global forces. Governments, banks, merchants, and consumers, they all have completely different motivations.
Entirely different.
The government wants taxes, the bank wants fees, the merchant wants security, and the consumer wants convenience. But they are all acting in their own self-interest to push the exact same wave forward.
And this is where the thermodynamic irreversibility locks in. For this wave to reverse.
For cash to come back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For cash to actually make a comeback and threaten Visa's secular waves. All four of those distinct groups would have to simultaneously decide to act completely against their own self-interests.
Wow.
Governments would have to suddenly prefer economic opacity, money laundering, and tax evasion. Banks would have to suddenly prefer losing billions of dollars in highly profitable fee revenue.
That's not happening.
Not a chance. Merchants would have to prefer slower checkout lines, higher security risks, and lower sales.
Mm.
And consumers would have to prefer the physical inconvenience of paper money.
Well, wait, let me push back on that for a second. What about systemic risks?
Like what?
Like if the power grid goes down, or if a massive cybersecurity threat compromises Visa's network, doesn't cash suddenly become the ultimate survival tool then? Couldn't a push for privacy or a fear of an Orwellian cashless society cause a structural reversal?
It is a vital point to consider. And yes, in a localized temporary crisis, say a hurricane knocks out power to a city for a week, cash is king.
Definitely.
But Dubé is looking at structural, multi-decade timelines.
Yeah.
A temporary power outage doesn't change the structural incentives of the global economy.
Yeah.
As for the privacy argument, while there is a vocal minority that deeply values financial anonymity.
The crypto cloud, for sure.
Right. But the overwhelming majority of the global population consistently trades privacy for convenience. Just look at social media or smartphone adoption.
Yep.
When forced to choose between the friction of anonymous cash and the frictionless convenience of digital payments, the masses choose convenience.
Every time.
Every time. As Dubé argues, the probability of a simultaneous permanent reversal across all four actors is effectively zero.
The egg doesn't unbreak.
The entire global financial system has moved to a lower energy, higher efficiency state. There is no natural force pushing it backward. It is thermodynamically irreversible in a structural sense. The broken egg cannot reassemble.
That is a profoundly reassuring way to look at a market trend.
It removes a lot of the anxiety.
It does. It moves it from the realm of, I hope people keep using credit cards, to, the laws of the universe dictate that they will.
Yeah.
But that leads us into the next phase of our deep dive.
The acceleration.
Yes. We've talked about the direction of the wave and why it can't go backward, but what about the speed? What accelerates these free surfers? Here's where it gets really interesting.
Chemistry.
Dubé brings chemistry into the financial framework, specifically the concept of autocatalysis.
Autocatalysis is a brilliant concept to apply to business models. In chemistry, an autocatalytic reaction is a process where the product of the reaction actually serves as a catalyst to accelerate the reaction itself.
It feeds itself.
It is the ultimate positive feedback loop. Dubé uses the analogy of a fire, which is the most visceral example. When a fire burns, the combustion of the wood releases heat.
Right.
That heat then raises the temperature of the surrounding unburned fuel, causing that new fuel to ignite.
Which releases more heat.
Which releases even more heat, which ignites even more fuel. The product of the reaction, the heat, is the very thing catalyzing and accelerating the process. The system feeds itself.
And Dubé finds a perfect, pure example of this happening right now in the financial markets with a company called MSCI.
MSCI is fascinating.
For those who don't spend their days looking at market data, MSCI is in the business of building and licensing indices. They create the rule books for things like the MSCI World Index or the MSCI Emerging Markets Index.
The benchmarks.
Right. These indices are then used by massive asset managers like BlackRock or Vanguard to build passive investment products like ETFs.
And that shift from active stock picking, where a guy in a suit tries to guess which stock will go up, to passive index investing, where you just buy the whole market, is already a massive irreversible wave on its own.
It's grown from a fringe idea in the 1970s to dominating the market today.
But Dubé points out that something else is acting as an autocatalyst here. Artificial intelligence.
This is where you see the chemical loop form in real time. We're seeing AI and machine learning algorithms take over more and more of portfolio construction and wealth management.
And AI doesn't sit down, look a CEO in the eye, and get a gut feeling about a stock.
No, it certainly doesn't.
AI optimizes massive data sets based on strict, quantifiable rules. It requires structured data to function. And what provides those roles in that structured data?
Indices like the ones MSCI builds. Let's trace this autocatalytic loop exactly as Dubé lays it out step by step, because it is fascinating.
Walk us through it.
Okay. More AI integration in the financial system leads directly to more passive, rules-based, systematic investing.
Step one.
Step two. More passive investing means more index licensing revenue flowing into MSCI's coffers.
Naturally.
Step three, MSCI then takes that increased revenue and uses it to gather, clean, and organize even more complex global financial data.
And step four, that richer, deeper data set is exactly what is needed to feed and train even better, more sophisticated AI products, which then allocate even more capital to passive indices.
Repeat, repeat, repeat.
Heat ignites fuel, which creates more heat. The system provides its own energy. It accelerates itself.
It is a profound wealth engine.
It is. But, and I want to step in here to temper the hype a bit, this is where we see Dubé's intellectual honesty shine through. And it's a crucial point for you as the listener to absorb.
Okay, lay it on us.
Dubé is not writing a blind hype piece. He explicitly steps in to remind us of another fundamental law of chemistry. Autocatalytic reactions are not infinite.
Right. A fire eventually burns out when it runs out of wood.
The reaction cannot exceed its fuel source. In chemistry and biology, these reactions follow what is known as a sigmoid curve.
The S curve.
Exactly. It looks like the letter S stretched out. It starts slow in a latency phase. Then, as the autocatalysis kicks in, it enters an explosive exponential growth phase where the line goes almost straight up.
The fire spreads.
But eventually, the curve hits an inflection point and flattens out into a plateau. It stops growing exponentially because the substrate, the raw material fueling the reaction, is consumed.
So if MSCI and the passive investing wave are an autocatalytic fire, what is the substrate? What is the wood fueling their fire?
According to Dubé, the substrate is the remaining pool of actively managed capital in the world.
That makes sense.
Let's look at the history to understand the curve. Back in the 1970s, when John Bogle started the first index fund, passive investing was maybe 1% of the market. People literally laughed at him and called it un-American to settle for average returns.
That was the latency phase.
Right. Then, over the decades, as people realized active managers charge high fees and rarely beat the market, the shift began. The 2008 financial crisis really accelerated it.
So where are we now?
Today, in the U.S. equity market, passive investing has reached roughly 50% of total assets.
Wow.
That means the other 50%, the actively managed money, is the remaining fuel. As that active capital continues to capitulate and shrink down to 40%, 30%, 20%, the autocatalytic reaction must, mathematically, begin to decelerate.
The sigmoid curve will start to flatten out.
Exactly.
But if active management shrinks to zero, does the market break? Because, I mean, who is setting the prices if everyone is just blindly buying the index?
It's the classic paradox of passive investing.
It is.
But practically speaking, active management will never hit absolute zero. There will always be a baseline of hedge funds, arbitragers, and individual stock pickers providing liquidity and price discovery.
Okay, good to know.
But it doesn't need to hit zero for the growth curve of MSCI to flatten. It just needs to reach equilibrium.
The plateau.
Right. The takeaway here for you, the investor, is that your job isn't to sit around assuming this magical growth loop will last literally forever. It won't.
So what is our job?
Your job is to look at the landscape and ask the structural question, where are we on the curve? Are we at the very beginning of the explosive phase, right in the middle, or are we approaching the plateau where the fuel is almost exhausted?
And Dubé's framework suggests that globally, especially outside the U.S. and across different asset classes like fixed income, we are still firmly in the exponential phase of this curve.
There's a lot of wood left to burn globally.
But you have to remain aware that the plateau exists. It's about measuring the remaining substrate.
Precisely. You have to monitor the fuel gauge, not just the speedometer.
I love that. All right, so we've covered the physics of why the wave moves and the chemistry of why it accelerates. But this all sounds very clean and theoretical. We need to talk about the real world.
Which is messy.
Very messy. And violent. This brings us to a critical part of Dubé's framework. Hostile terrain, inefficiency.
This is crucial.
We have to look at the dangers of the market through the eyes of two absolute titans of mathematics and theory. Benoit Mandelbrot and Claude Shannon. Let's start with Mandelbrot, who was a pioneering mathematician focused on fractal geometry.
Mandelbrot's work is essential because it dismantles a very dangerous, comforting assumption that almost all orthodox finance is built upon.
What assumption is that?
Traditional finance, modern portfolio theory, and most risk models assume that market returns follow a normal distribution, a standard bell curve.
It's a bell curve.
In a bell curve, most days are average, and extreme events are supposed to be vanishingly rare. A massive 50% market crash might be modeled as a 10,000-year event or a Six Sigma event.
Meaning mathematically, you effectively don't need to worry about it happening in your lifetime.
Right. But Mandelbrot actually looked at decades of real, raw market data. Cotton prices, stock prices, currency fluctuations. And he discovered that the market does not care about the bell curve.
It does its own thing.
Market movements are fractal. That means they look the same, whether you are zooming in on a frantic 5-minute chart or zooming out to a decade-long historical chart. The chaos is self-similar at every scale.
Wow.
They do not follow safe, predictable distributions. They follow what mathematicians call power laws with fat tails.
Fat tails. Let's define that.
A fat tail is a statistical way of saying that extreme catastrophic events happen far more frequently than the standard bell curve predicts.
Okay.
Those theoretical 10,000-year crashes, the ones that are supposed to be impossible, in Mandelbrot's fractal reality, they happen every decade.
Just look at recent history.
Exactly. Think about the last 25 years. We had the dot-com crash in 2000, the global financial crisis in 2008, the flash crash in 2010, the COVID plunge in 2020.
It's relentless.
Extreme drawdowns are not anomalies. They are the norm. The market is structurally, fundamentally more hostile and dangerous than standard financial models are willing to admit. The black swan is actually a guaranteed feature of the geometry of the market.
So how does Dubé apply Mandelbrot's terrifying warning to our portfolio?
The core takeaway here is that survival must precede compounding.
Survival first.
In a hostile fractal market where extreme crashes are guaranteed to happen regularly, you have to survive the crash to enjoy the compounding on the other side.
And this brings us to a devastating mathematical reality that Dubé calls the volatility tax.
The volatility tax is the silent killer of wealth. It is the simple, brutal math that ruins so many portfolios.
Let's run a quick simulation for the listener.
Let's do it. Say you have $100,000 in a highly volatile tech stock. A fractal fat tail event hits the market and your stock drops 50%.
Ouch.
You now have $50,000. The market bombs down. and the next year your stock gains 50%.
You might think, great, I'm back to where I started.
But you aren't. 50% of $50,000 is $25,000. You were only at $75,000. To recover from a 50% loss, you don't need a 50% gain.
You need a 100% gain just to get back to zero. And if you have a massive 75% drawdown, you need a 300% gain just to break even. The hole gets exponentially deeper.
It does. If returns were normally distributed and mostly hovered around the average, this tax would be a minor annoyance. But in Mandelbrot's fractal market of frequent extreme drawdowns, the volatility tax is lethal.
It destroys long-term compounding because you spend years just climbing out of the crater.
Precisely.
So how does the free surfer survive this hostile terrain? How does it avoid the crater? If we connect this to the bigger picture,
Dubé points out that the free surfer is inherently structurally anti-fragile. Think back to our fundamental equation, A multiplied by B.
Right.
The A, that incredibly stable recurring cash flow, the mandatory toll booth, it acts like a piton driven deep into the rock face during an avalanche.
It holds you in place.
It absorbs the massive shocks of the fat tail events. Why?
Hmm.
Because the cash keeps flowing regardless of market panic. Even in 2008, people still had to swipe their Visa cards to buy groceries.
Very.
The A limits the downside. And the B, that irreversible structural wave of growth, ensures that the recovery is automatic and rapid once the panic subsides.
Which perfectly transitions us to Claude Shannon, the father of information theory.
Shannon is a legend.
He was a genius at Bell Labs who basically invented the digital bit. But he also dabbled in investing and gambling theory. Shannon discovered something that sounds almost like magic, a concept often referred to as Shannon's demon.
It really does sound like magic.
Shannon proved mathematically that you can take a highly volatile asset that has an expected long-term return of literally zero, it just goes wildly up and down like a yo-yo, but goes absolute nowhere over time, and you can extract a positive return from it simply through mechanical rebalancing.
It is entirely counterintuitive, but the math is bulletproof.
Walk us through it.
Shannon showed that if you mechanically rebalance between that volatile, zero-return asset and a stable asset like cash, say keeping a strict 50-50 split, you create a wealth engine.
Let's do the numbers.
Let's say you start with $1,000. $500 in cash, $500 in the volatile stock.
Yep.
The stock halves in value to $250. Your total portfolio is now $750. You rebalance back to 50-50, so you move cash into the stock. You now have $375 in each.
Got it.
Then the stock doubles back to its original price. Your stock portion is now $750, plus your $375 in cash. Your portfolio is now $1,125.
Wait, the stock went nowhere. It halved and then doubled back to its starting price. But your portfolio grew by 12.5%.
Exactly. You systematically forced yourself to sell high and buy low without ever having to predict the market. You are mathematically extracting order from noise. You are turning volatility into a positive return.
But wait, isn't Shannon's demon inherently about active trading? You literally have to constantly rebalance the portfolio to harvest the volatility. I thought Dubé's whole premise was that we shouldn't be trading.
That is the genius of Dubé's connection here. He offers a brilliant insight. The free surfer is essentially Shannon's demon inverted and internalized.
Inverted and internalized.
Yes. Shannon extracts returns from volatility by actively, mechanically trading and rebalancing. The free surfer, on the other hand, extracts massive wealth from structural growth by not trading. Because the free surfer's cash flows are so incredibly stable and its structural growth is so relentless, it naturally minimizes the volatility tax on its own.
It doesn't suffer those massive drawdowns.
Exactly. It doesn't suffer the massive 50 or 60% drawdowns that require constant rebalancing to survive. It pays the absolute lowest volatility tax of any asset class relative to how fast it compounds.
So you don't need to trade to extract the value.
No, the internal structure of the business does it for you.
Okay, so we've pulled together an incredible array of sciences here. We have the gradient from physics, irreversibility from thermodynamics, autocatalysis from chemistry, fat tails from fractal geometry, and Shannon's demon from information theory.
That's a lot to process.
It is a lot. But this brings us to what might be the most practical part of Dubé's work, systems thinking and the taxonomy of free surfers. This is where we tie all these disparate scientific laws into one unified engine.
To tie it all together, Dubé utilizes systems thinking, drawing on the work of pioneers like Donella Meadows and Peter Senge.
Systems thinking.
In systems thinking, you don't just look at isolated parts. You look for reinforcing loops. A reinforcing loop isn't just a linear chain where A causes B.
Right.
It's a circular chain of cause and effect where every single element amplifies the next, sustaining itself indefinitely as long as the structural conditions hold.
And the Free Surfer is the ultimate converging loop of all these scientific laws we've discussed. Let's trace the full loop Dubé maps out.
Let's do it.
First, you have the wave of demand growing, driven by the thermodynamic irreversibility of four actors acting in their own self-interest.
That's the push.
Because the business has a zero-cost B, a freebie, that revenue growth translates perfectly, dollar for dollar, into free cash flow.
The cash generation.
The business then takes that massive, gushing free cash flow and mechanically buys back its own shares on the open market.
Which is a crucial mechanical step. By shrinking the share count, they accelerate the free cash flow per share.
And Wall Street loves that.
They do. When the broader market sees that per share acceleration, it re-rates the stock higher. As the stock price goes higher, the company's market capitalization expands.
And that triggers the passive wave.
Exactly. That expansion forces Darwinian, rules-based index funds, like the massive ETFs tracking the S&P 500, to mechanically allocate even more capital into the stock, regardless of valuation.
It's forced buying.
Yes. This capital inflow provides more resources and stability, which fuels the chemical autocatalysis we talked about earlier, speeding up the underlying wave even more.
The cycle restarts on a higher base, driven simultaneously by physics, chemistry, corporate mechanics, and Darwinian selection.
It's a flawless converging machine.
It really is. But as Dubé meticulously details, you can't just slap the Free Surfer label on a company and walk away.
No, they aren't all identical.
Not all of these machines are shaped exactly the same way or react to the environment in the same way. He provides a taxonomy, breaking down Free Surfers into four distinct subspecies.
Understanding the nuance of how the zero-cost B operates in different macroeconomic environments is crucial for building a durable portfolio.
Let's spend some real time on these. We'll start with the first one, the classic Free Surfer.
The classic Free Surfer is the purest, most elegant expression of the entire model. Visa and MasterCard are the undeniable archetypes here.
Simple and clean.
Incredibly simple. You have one massive secular wave, which is the global digitalization of payments, and you have one pure frictionless toll mechanism, which is the tiny fraction of a percent they collect on every single transaction processed over their network.
The A is the toll, the B is the wave, and the cost of B is strictly zero.
There is no ambiguity. It relies purely on the volume of economic activity.
So if the world economy grows, the classic Free Surfer grows. If inflation pushes prices up, the classic Free Surfer gets a raise automatically because their toll is a percentage of the nominal transaction value.
It's beautiful.
It is. But what happens if the economy actually shrinks? That brings us to the second subspecies, the resilient Free Surfer.
Right.
And Dubé uses Moody's, the credit rating agency, as the archetype here. What makes Moody's more resilient than a classic Free Surfer like Visa?
The key difference lies in the nature of the toll itself.
Okay.
The classic Free Surfer like Visa, if you decide not to go to the restaurant and you don't swipe your card, Visa doesn't get paid.
True.
The toll is structural, but it is purely transactional. If transaction volumes drop in a severe recession, Visa's revenue will take a hit. With Moody's, however, the toll is mandatory and regulatory. When a massive corporation or a sovereign nation issues debt, they are structurally required by financial regulation and market convention to get a rating from Moody's and S&P.
Right. If Apple or the government of France wants to issue billions in bonds, the mutual funds and pension funds literally are not legally allowed to buy those bonds unless they have that official stamp of approval from Moody's.
The toll is inescapable.
Inescapable.
Yeah, exactly. The wave they ride is the centuries-long expansion of global debt issuance. But here is where the extreme resilience kicks in. Think about a scenario like 2022. When the Federal Reserve aggressively hiked interest rates by 500 basis points.
It was brutal.
The cost of borrowing skyrocketed, and new corporate debt issuance fell off a cliff. Companies simply stopped issuing new bonds.
So Moody's should have suffered, right?
A normal business reliant on that volume would be crushed. But Moody's still generated massive free cash flow. Why? Because all the thousands and thousands of existing bonds that are already out in the world, sitting in pension funds, require ongoing paid surveillance.
Surveillance fees.
Yes. The corporations have to pay Moody's every year to maintain the rating on the existing debt. The toll renews automatically regardless of new volume. Therefore, the resilient Free Surfer has the highest absolute revenue floor of any subspecies. it is the hardest to kill in a severe economic contraction.
That is a brilliant distinction. The recurring surveillance fee acts as the ultimate shock absorber. Okay, moving to the third subspecies, the double swell free surfer.
We touched on this earlier when we discussed the chemistry of autocatalysis with MSCI.
Yes, MSCI is the perfect archetype of the double swell.
Instead of riding one linear wave, it is simultaneously riding two deeply coupled, interlocking waves. Wave one is the structural migration from expensive active stock picking to low-cost passive index investing.
And wave two?
Wave two is the integration of artificial intelligence and algorithmic trading into portfolio management.
And as we discussed with the fire analogy, these waves feed each other. The growth of passive investing creates the structured data sets that AI models desperately need to train on.
And as AI becomes more prevalent, it accelerates the shift toward passive, rules-based strategies that rely entirely on MSCI's indices.
It's a double swell, creating explosive, nonlinear compounding during its acceleration phase.
It grows faster than the classic or the resilient models, but you have to monitor that sigmoid curve we talked about to see when the fuel might run low.
Right. Keep an eye on the substrate. Which leads us to the final and perhaps most robust and complex subspecies in Dubé's entire taxonomy, the hybrid free surfer.
The archetype here is S&P Global.
Okay.
The hybrid is what happens when you combine multiple free surfer engines inside a single corporate structure.
S&P Global is fascinating because it isn't just one business. It is a collection of monopolies.
Very true.
They own S&P Dow Jones Indices, which builds the S&P 500 index. That division acts exactly like a classic free surfer riding the passive wave, just like MSCI.
But they also house a massive credit ratings division, which acts exactly like a resilient free surfer riding the debt issuance wave cooperatively in an oligopoly with Moody's.
And it doesn't stop there.
It doesn't. They also have a massive market intelligence division. This division benefits from what tech folks call data gravity.
Data.
Yeah, the idea that data attracts more data and more applications, making it incredibly hard for customers to leave once they're plugged in.
Okay.
Imagine a junior analyst at an investment bank. Their entire workflow, all their Excel models, are linked directly to S&P's Capital IQ data feed. If the managing director says, "We're switching to a cheaper data provider," the analyst's entire workflow breaks.
The switching costs are astronomically high.
Exactly. The data has gravity. It holds the customer in orbit. S&P also owns Platts, which provides the mandatory pricing benchmarks for global commodities like oil and natural gas.
So you have four distinct toll booth businesses, at least three massive secular waves, and multiple reinforcing loops, all living under one ticker symbol.
As Dubé points out, the hybrid represents the absolute densest convergence of these physical forces. It offers maximum irreversibility and maximum redundancy.
If the passive investing wave temporarily slows down, the debt issuance wave might be surging.
If debt issuance stalls, the data subscriptions keep renewing. It is a financial fortress.
So what does this all mean? We have journeyed through physics, thermodynamics, chemistry, fractal geometry, and information theory.
A heavy scientific tour.
We've defined the free surfer, looked at empirical evidence of capital flowing down the gradient, and categorized the subspecies. This brings us to section six, the implication for the listener. How does all of this heavy scientific theory actually change what you, the investor listening right now, do with your brokerage account on a Monday morning?
It changes absolutely everything.
How so?
Dubé delivers a profoundly disorienting insight here. He argues that this framework entirely redefines the role of the investor. Think about how a traditional portfolio is managed.
Okay.
In a traditional setup, what Dubé calls mechanical duration, or A plus BU, the human investor, are the engine of compounding.
Right.
The success of the portfolio relies entirely on your constant human intervention. You have to monitor the quarterly earnings. You have to decide when to trim a position. You have to guess when to rebalance. Mm-hmm. You have to read the macro tea leaves to decide if you should be in cyclical stocks or defensive stocks. Exactly. If you stop paying attention, if you stop making decisions, the engine stalls.
But in a free surfer portfolio, what Dubé calls physical duration, or A multiplied by B, the human is no longer the engine.
That is the ultimate realization. The laws are the engine.
The natural laws.
Thermodynamic irreversibility is driving the payment wave forward. Autocatalysis is accelerating the passive index wave. The internal reinforcing loop of free cash flow and share buybacks is sustaining the compounding.
The zero-cost structure of the business is automatically minimizing the fractal volatility tax.
In this paradigm, Dubé argues that your only job as an investor is to clearly see the gradient, identify the structural forces at play, carefully position your capital in these rare vehicles, and then get entirely out of the way.
And getting out of the way might be the hardest part for most people.
It really is.
We are deeply conditioned by the financial media to believe that investing requires constant, frenetic action. If you aren't sweating over a spreadsheet, reading a 10K, or reacting to a news headline about interest rates, you feel like you're failing.
You feel irresponsible.
Exactly. But Dubé's framework proves that velocity, action, and high IQ forecasting aren't the main advantages in wealth creation. Certainty is the advantage, and natural laws provide the highest level of certainty available.
This raises a very practical question for you, the listener.
Right.
If you aren't trading, how often should you actually do anything?
Right.
Dubé suggests that a true free surfer portfolio requires a check-in, perhaps once a year.
Once a year.
And when you do check in, you don't ask the Wall Street questions. Do they beat earnings estimates by a penny, or what is their forward PE multiple?
You don't ask those.
No. You ask the physicist's question. Are the underlying structural laws still operating?
Is the world still relentlessly moving toward digital payments?
Are global capital markets still structurally expanding and requiring debt ratings?
Is the shift toward passive, rules-based investing still unfolding along the sigmoid curve?
And if the answer to those macro structural questions is yes, and as Dubé points out, the answers have been a resounding yes for decades, then your portfolio requires absolute zero intervention.
You don't optimize. You don't tinker.
You don't try to trade around a minor recession because physics doesn't take a sabbatical. Time is the only remaining variable that matters. The longer you leave the system alone, the more the natural laws compound your wealth.
That is the ultimate liberation for the investor. It is the transition from a state of anxious, constant activity to a state of confident immobility. You stop fighting the market and start letting the underlying laws of physics and mathematics do the heavy lifting for you.
It really is a beautiful, almost serene way to look at wealth creation.
So to quickly recap the expansive journey we've been on today, we started by looking at a business not as a stock ticker, but as a mathematical equation of existing operations and future growth.
The A and the B.
We learned that the ultimate wealth engine is the free surfer, where the marginal cost of that growth is structurally zero. We traced how capital flows down the gradient toward these businesses, propelled by thermodynamically irreversible waves driven by the self-interest of multiple actors.
Governments, banks, merchants, and consumers.
Right. We saw how chemistry's autocatalysis can exponentially accelerate that growth, and how the mathematics of Shannon and Mandelbrot prove that this zero capex structure survives the most hostile fractal markets by organically minimizing the volatility tax.
It is the anatomy of the perfect compounding machine.
It really is.
And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final, perhaps provocative thought that builds on everything Dubé has laid out today.
Let's hear it.
If Dubé's framework is fundamentally correct, if capital naturally and inevitably flows down the gradient through these zero-cost B free surfers, and if the ultimate logical destination of a mature portfolio is to converge entirely on these assets where human intervention approaches zero, what does that say about the entire multi-trillion dollar industry of active management?
Oh, that is a massive existential question for Wall Street.
Think about it deeply. Is the entire apparatus of financial forecasting, day trading, algorithmic high-frequency trading, and constant portfolio shuffling, essentially just a massive high-friction, high-cost B activity?
Wow.
Are the millions of highly educated professionals trying to outsmart the market every quarter simply fighting against the inevitable thermodynamic pull of the universe?
Pushing against gravity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If the natural laws of capital inherently favor the automated, frictionless structure of the free surfer, then active traders aren't just wasting their energy. They are effectively trying to push water uphill.
That is something that will definitely stick with you the next time you see a frantic analyst screaming on financial television about a 50 basis point rate cut. Are they riding the structural wave, or are they exhausting themselves trying to push water uphill against the laws of physics?
It's a question every investor needs to answer for themselves.
Well, we have covered an immense amount of ground, and that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us on this exploration of the natural laws of wealth. This is Averaging Up the Infinite Investor by Jocelyn Dubé. We will see you next time.